Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fourth Age podcast continuing recap of The Gathering Storm. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with us this episode is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be back as usual, and with us also this episode is Spencer.
Hey, everyone. It's great to be here. This episode we're going to start with Chapter 19. Before we do that, though, we got a couple of things to take care of. First off is our customary spoiler warning. We are going to be talking about all of the books in the Wheel of Time series. So if you have not read them all, especially The Gathering Storm, as we're going into detail, then you might want to put off listening to this podcast until after you have and come back later.
That's true. We have a tendency to spoil every single book, and we have also been known to have crossover spoilers and tangent spoilers, so it's very possible that we might even spoil other series of books or movies or TV shows or probably anything else that our little ramblings come across. So we will try to give fair warning in advance, but just be warned, there will be spoilers. Anything that might be related to the Wheel of Time and some things that aren't.
He was dead the entire time.
Who? Moi?
It's all a fever dream.
Oh. So Elaine's going to wake up and she's still just the daughter heir of Andor? And what? What?
No,
no, Rand's going to wake up and realize that the daughter heir of Andor is climbing down a tree.
Well, getting ready to treat his fractured skull, right? Oh, dear. All the last couple of years have just been one feverish nightmare.
And he can
really
do it
dragon,
right.
Yeah, he isn't really a dragon reborn. There isn't anybody else in his head. Nobody's bonding him. He can just go back to the Two Rivers and be a sheep herder. Woo!
No, because at that point he had already channeled. So, anyway.
Well, then he can go back to the Two Rivers and slip slowly into madness.
And kill everybody? Yeah. And our second order of business is, before we start actually using the materials, the summaries that we'll be using for our chapters for this episode and all our other episodes are mostly based on the work that is on Encyclopedia Watt, which is a great resource. We want to thank Bob Klutz for everything he's done on that.
All right, yeah, we definitely want to thank encyclopedia-watt.org. It's a fantastic resource for Wheel of Time fans. You can find a reference to pretty much anybody in the series or any place or any item that you need to know more about, and they're all extensively cross-referenced, and it's really quite fantastic. And Bob Klutz is the administrator of that site, and he's a great guy. And we are, unfortunately, borrowing heavily from his summaries, which I think we haven't asked to do, but hopefully it'll be okay. We're giving full credit where credit is due, though. We did not write these summaries. They are there for you to read on encyclopedia-watt.org. So check it out. It's good stuff.
Yeah, and especially if we're going along and you hear us spout off a name that you don't recognize or place or something that you don't know what is, then definitely get onto encyclopedia-watt, find the chapter summary, because on each summary there are links to each and every random thing. So if you don't know what we're talking about, then you can go to Encyclopedia Watt, click on the link, and you can find out.
That's right. And you will find a list of every time in the series that character, item, place, or anything else has been mentioned. It's really quite an amazing work when you think about it. Very, very incredible and really worth looking at. So I can't think of any other in the Wheel of Time world.
We'd also like to thank the ASPCAS. We definitely wanted to mention that no Aes Sedai were harmed in the making of this podcast.
But we're not going to guarantee that no Dark Friends were. Well, what about the Black Aja? We kind of toasted a few of those.
Oh, I know we did, but we don't count them as Aes Sedai.
Oh, okay. Well, they count themselves as Aes Sedai still, don't they?
I certainly have an hope not.
They have an Aja. They call it the Aja. Remember when Masana said, oh, you little children almost match the Aja, you know, in something. I can't remember.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, and I thought, what?
Yes, but the Aes Sedai is the servants of all. That's what the Aes Sedai means. And the black Aja are servants of themselves and incredibly selfish creatures. And so I don't think they could be considered Aes Sedai, no matter what they call themselves.
Yeah, well, that's their private joke on the world.
At least that's the way that I'm getting by that oath.
Yeah. They call themselves the servants of all that they want. The servants of all their own personal desires and aggrandizement.
Yeah.
So, I think we thanked everybody that we can thank. I'd like to thank the Academy for giving me this opportunity. Long speech. Alright, well, we're going to begin this read-through of The Gathering Storm with Chapter 19, which is entitled Gambit. And this chapter begins with Tuon's point of view. She is in her audience chamber in the Terrasen Palace the day after her return to Ebu Dar. Thoric Kareed and 24 Death Watch guards and 6 Ogier gardeners stand guard. Ebu Dar is in order, but the rest of the world is in chaos. The progress of the Koran is stalled by the Dragon Reborn in the east and the Domani in the north. They have not heard from Lieutenant General Turan, but Galgan thinks that there is a chance that he will succeed. It will be difficult to recover from Suras' betrayal. On the right of her are 10 Dakovale, on the left are Linnell, Melatine, and their Damani. Suras will not be among the Dakovale until her hair grows out. Tuon still wears ashes to mourn the Empress's death. She takes her seat, and Seleucia and Ural stand beside her. Seleucia is now her voice. Tuon thinks it is curious with all these guards that she feels no safer than she did with Matt. Several members of the Blood stand before her, including Captain General Galgan, Banner General Najira, Banner General Yamada, Javier Nofish, and Aminar Shumada. Tuon announces that Seleucia is now also her truth speaker, and she still finds it hard to believe Falendri's story that Anoth was one of the Forsaken. Beslan then enters for an audience. They share condolences for the loss of their mothers. Although he acts conciliatory, Tuon says that she knows of his rebellious meetings with General Habinger and Lord Mawalin in the Three Stars. She convinces him that it is best for all for him to rule Atara in her name, and he swears fealty to her. It is not exactly the proper oath, but she thanks her conversations with Mr. Sinan for giving her the insight that she must adapt as well. She raises Beslan to the High Blood. Galgan now has an audience. He informs her that the Dragon Reborn has again requested a meeting. Tuon formally announces that they will stay in these lands and not retreat to Shanshan. It is more important to stay here so the Dragon Reborn can bow before the Crystal Throne. Galgan then passes the audience to Lieutenant General Yulon. His concern is that the White Tower and the great weapon that the Marathamani used north of Ebu Dar is still in existence. He proposes a tactical strike on the White Tower to capture or kill as many Marathamani as possible. They will use 8,200 Torakan, 200 troops, 50 Soldam, and a few blood knives, which are suicide assassins. While she is contemplating a final decision, another Shojin, Makombi, enters to announce Lieutenant General Tylee Kirgan. Tylee brings news of the Trolloc attack outside Ebu Dar and several Trolloc heads for proof. Galgan sends runners to organize patrols to search for the Trollocs. Tuon wonders what other of Matt's quote-unquote superstitions are true. Tuon says that this is yet more proof that the last battle is coming and that they must subdue the Dragon Reborn. Tylee offers that he may make a better ally than an enemy. Tuon orders Galgan to set up a meeting with the Dragon Reborn. Curiously, she finds herself wishing that Matt were there with her.
There are also a couple of notes here, which should probably be pointed out. Very early, they mentioned that they think that there is definite hope that Turan will succeed in his battle. He did not.
Mm-hmm.
And they mentioned the mention of the great Maras Damane weapon used north of Ebu Dar is, in fact, Elaine's attempt at unweaving a gateway, which unfortunately resulted in its collapse and very, very violent eruption.
Nuclear explosions.
Yes, it is quite the thing. And I think that the funniest thing about that was that Avianda told her that, you know, Elaine said that she was kind of sorry to see it, but that she was glad that they at least had discovered a new weapon. But then Avienda said it could have been anything from the massive explosion that resulted from Elaine's attempt to a little puff of air and a clap of thunder, you know. So it isn't really a very reliable weapon at all, but the Shangchen don't know that.
One of the things that struck me recently with this particular passage was the question, are these Trollocs fresh reinforcements that have been sent through the ways? Or, and I know this stretches credulity quite a bit, since they are still in the same general area of the world, that is there even the slightest possibility that this might be the same Trolloc band that Fane had originally brought with him when he was carrying the Horn of Valyr? Because I don't remember whatever happened to them.
Well, I have a feeling that they would have been discovered before this.
But if they were discovered, they probably would have been discovered by the Shangchen. And, from Kylie's reaction to them, Tuan's and basically anyone else, the Shangchen who has seen a Trolloc, it seems like they're still very, very new things. Like, you think word would spread if, half man, half animal hybrids walking around slaughtering and killing people, Now, that's not to say that one of the Forsaken didn't scoop them up somehow at some point.
I think it would sure catch my attention if, giant half man, half animal creatures were running around slaughtering people, but then, maybe they're not very observant. I sort of wonder if these are the same ones that there were reports of around Ebadar before Elaine and company decamped to the Kinsmen.
Yeah, that's very possible, too. The only reason I would even pose the suggestion that they're one group or the other, comes from that concept that the time frame of the novels is a lot shorter than most of us typically imagine them to be. It was a minor thought just to kind of throw out there. I think as far as the rest of the chapter goes, I was really happy that Beslan wasn't stupid, because there was a great chance that he could have been. And I like that Tuan's talks with Mr. Sinan did have a pronounced effect on her.
Yeah, me too. I've always liked, her. And I've always thought that, Mr. Sinan had some sort of a place with Tuan in the future. And I'm really not sure how that will actually work out. And again, I got a little bit of derisive commentary the last time I proposed that the burned out former Aes Sedai, probably Amarlin, Setala Anan, would go on to become, an advisor to the Empress of the Shangchen. But I don't think it's impossible.
No, it's definitely not impossible, especially because, as I point out here, and Andrew just said, they have a history. They've grown to trust each other, and Tuan actually has taken advice from her.
Yeah.
I have to wonder if they'll ever actually meet up again, because I just have this feeling that Mistress Anon is either going to be swept up by the tower, by some Aes Sedai in the tower, either Nynaeve trying to heal her and is successful or something, or she's going to die. Which would be sad.
It would be sad. I don't want her to die. I want her to get healed.
Especially where she hasn't seen her family in so long. But I do not believe that she is going to come back to her family in the same condition that they left her. Either she's going to come as a cold body, or she's going to come as a channeling someone.
Oh, I confess I'd like to see her get healed and return to the Aes Sedai fold. Am I wrong when I'm remembering that she might have been... I guess I originally thought that she was one of the Aes Sedai that was studying Turangueil and got burned out by accident, but she has such a presence about her that I almost wonder if she wasn't, one of the deposed Amarlin.
I don't know. I mean, would it be possible that one of the deposed Amarlins was recent enough that she would still be alive?
No. I know the two 20 years ago were both killed. I don't know. I think she was probably just a regular Aes Sedai who was burned out, studying Turangueil, because that was mentioned in the book more than once, I believe. Anyway, I digress.
I did also kind of like, once again, and it'll reappear in many, 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 many chapters with Dwan and Matt that both of them are so horribly, horribly cute, and that they are consistently thinking about the other, and particularly here where, you know, two or three times Dwan's like, oh, you know, I have all these, you know, Ogier gardeners and Death Watch guards, and I don't really feel that much safer than when I was, you know, traveling around with Matt. And, oh, you know, it would have been really nice, you know, having this entire meeting here with, you know, if Matt were here. And just, you know, that kind of thing where it makes that earlier thought about, oh, well, you know, my mother was said to be in love with my father. It's possible, you know. No. No, I'm sorry. You're in love. Face it.
Yeah, they are definitely the cutest couple because they're both in love with the other. They're both mooning over the other, but neither of them will admit it to themselves, which I think is humorous and just romantically cute.
I know, and they're such complete opposites. I mean, culturally, physically, on almost every level. And they're just, they have, like, nothing in common except they both love horses. Ugh. Is that enough to build a relationship on? I don't know. Well, Matt has the aura of greatness about him, and she was obviously born to it, so I suppose they have that going for him.
Yeah, no, I was just looking at the character page for Satellanon on Encyclopedia Watt, and it seems like whoever wrote this believes that that Satellanon was Martin Janata, who was an Aes Sedai who specialized in studying Tharangriel until she was stilled by one. And there is a lot of evidence for that, especially in the private moments between her and Matt. And
yeah, well,
with Matt's
Tharangriel. She just wants to see it. Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, well, I kind of thought that before even the Gathering Storm that she was the burned out. I said, I don't know where the thing about her possibly being a former animal.
Oh, well, actually,
that sort of just crept into my head just this minute.
Well, but actually, in Knife of Dreams, she admits that she was once an Aes Sedai. It has yet to come out and actually specifically say who she is, but considering the amount of research that goes into Encyclopedia Watt, I would trust their judgment in that there is a high probability that she is Martin Janata.
Yeah. I concur. I have to say, I just had this spaz out moment where I started reading part of the next chapter summary and my brain sort of skipped a comma. So the first sentence that I wrote is Matt riding Pips and Tomani's ride along an ancient broken road. Okay.
That's a great mental picture.
That's a visual you did not need, huh?
Matt on Tomani's shoulders on Pip's back.
There you go. It must all be Saldaean, you know, like Dav and Bashir riding along with one foot on each horse and the other guy is riding with, you know, one guy on the other guy's shoulders while they're racing along at full tilt or whatever. I thought that was interesting. I had no idea the Saldaeans went in for circus tricks like that. Whee!
Well, anything that might be necessary for fighting Trollocs.
Yeah, riding two horses at one time, that's definitely a necessity in battle.
Well, if you have to deliver a horse to somebody who's been dehorsed really quickly.
Or if you're trying to stop a runaway horse.
There you go.
Or if you're trying to just awe the Trollocs into stopping and watching you for a while your compatriots sneak up behind them and start slitting throats.
I vote for that. Put on a circus show and let the Trollocs be bemused. Ooh. What are they doing now? Narg, look.
Well, I was, since we are on the topic once again of Trollocs, I was really, really happy to see that Tylee makes it here, because the last we saw of her, if I'm not mistaken, was at the beginning of the Trolloc attack.
Yeah.
So we did get closure that yes, she's still alive, because I would have been very, very, very irritated if nobody had survived that particular attack.
Yeah. I always liked Tylee. She's kind of cool. I'm just kind of sorry that her lieutenant got killed, and his name escapes me now.
No.
I'm sorry to see him die, but I don't remember who he was.
Oh, I remember it. I can see his face. I just can't think of his name.
We were sad to see him go, but we loved to watch him leave. I mean...
whatever. Taking an arrow through the throat is never a pretty way to die.
No. But particularly just the rather stunned look that had to have, like, what the heck? Arrowed.
I'm dead? What?
Oh, my God.
I also
yeah,
liked it,
arrow.
Though. I also liked it because she's bringing in proof that Matt just isn't telling tall tales. You know,
yeah.
And, you know, before the last battle is concluded with Juwan's going to have to be disabused, that old people on this side of the ocean are all this way, they're all silly, they believe weird things, and they're all terrible oath breakers who are all evil people and, you know, must be completely subdued and blah, 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 blah.
I believe she actually rapped Matt on the head for believing in troll extension.
No, it was the elfin and the elfin.
Oh, right, but yeah, also true.
Yep. Whereas, you know, counting the ants and birds spinning through the air and that, those are completely valid omens.
Oh,
and not at
scientific.
All crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely scientific, you know, proof positive.
Well, of course,
well,
when the owl hoots three times in the night in succession while being interrupted by a night lurk, you obviously know that that means somebody in your immediate family is going to die.
Right. Oh, and it didn't rain like we thought. Well, clearly, Seleucia miscounted with the ants.
It was human error because the omens do not lie.
That's right. Hang on a second. I got to mute myself for a minute.
It was an error malfunction.
Error 404. No error found.
Oh, this is priceless.
What did you laugh? What did you laugh about? I missed it. I'm sorry.
Error 404. No error found.
Yeah.
We're going to continue then with Chapter 20, On a Broken Road. Matt and Talmanis ride along an ancient broken road through foothills northeast of the Damona Mountains, leading the Band of the Red Hand. It is a few days since the battle with the Shanshan army and Tuan's departure. They're heading toward Camelin to rejoin Esten and Darid. Vannon checks Master Roydal's map, figuring their position with landmarks, Blinder's Peak, Mount Sardalen, and Favland Mountain. He rides forward to scout and returns. Matt wonders if the Shanshan will chase him, since he and Tuan are on different sides of the war now. He is still unsure how he feels about his marriage to Tuan. Tamana says he thinks some of the great captains are married, Davram Bashir and Rodel Itrald for sure. Alver and Noel ride up. Alver has been working out how to sneak into the Tower of Genji. Vannon returns with news that the village of Hinderstap is just ahead. Juline, Edesina, and Teslin ride up. They want to know how far they are from Camelin. Vannon says 200 leagues, a little over a week for someone with spare horses, 20 days with the whole band. Juline and Edesina want to go off on their own to get there to get to Camelin quicker. They demand horses for the two Soldam. Matt sends them off in a huff, then sends Vannon to tell Mondavwin to prepare to make camp. A few of them will go into the village for supplies, and Talmanis mentions idly that concerning supplies at the Two Rivers Tabak, which was a gift from King Rodoran, is now gone. Matt plans to gamble his personal money for supplies. Egwene or Nynaeve would box his ears at the idea, but Talmanis is very enthusiastic about the prospect.
Because Talmanis knows that Matt has never, ever, ever lost, nor ever will.
Yeah,
except
not likely.
When he needs to.
Right. Except when it's expedient for him to do so. So, a couple of little notes here. The two Soldam that Jolene and Edesina want to take with them were Bethamin and Seda, Rena having been killed. Also, the other great captains that are not married, or that we do not know if they're married or not, were Gareth Bryn, who has apparently never been married, except to his job. And then we do not know if Aglamar Jagad and Pedrineal were married, although I believe that Pedrineal reflects that he never had been, but he wished that Morghese, or that he'd been a little bit younger, because he was kind of, he was a little bit smitten with Morghese, I believe. Such a pity she was tainted by the witches.
And even Valda.
Well, that was, he reflected that prior to even Valda's advent and nastiness with Morghese. So I was kind of struck by the, probably Teslin. They've evidently had a number of falling outs with Teslin. But would they actually leave her behind? I don't know.
This, I mean, honestly, this is a nice little checking in sort of chapter. By and large, not a whole lot is really important here. It establishes where Matt is in the story, because when last we saw him, he was heading towards the pass through the Demona Mountains. So the idea that, you know, we've not really seen him very much to find out, oh, look, he's lost on some back road through the mountains of mist. And it kind of sets up that, okay, he's going to be going into this fly speck of a village called Hinderstab. More than likely, he's probably going to get into some sort of fix in Hinderstab. But, you know, so far, not much is really happening except that supplies are running light, but supplies are running light all over the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, Matt's just kind of, we're kind of getting reacquainted with Matt and his manner of getting things done now that Tuan is not around. And again, of course, it gives us a little bit of a, you know, Matt's like, I'm not sure what to make of my marriage, but you know, oh, you know, he's thinking of Tuan, and it's, you know, it makes it obvious. I kind of felt, because we've had this weird issue about Master Roydel's maps and Vanna not really trusting them, that seemed to me a little bit of a rehash, because, okay, you know, it's going to come back that the map is accurate after all, and, you know, yay. But, I mean, you know, by and large, this is a placeholder chapter.
Well, and it's also a completely necessary introduction to one of my most least favorite, actually, chapters in the book, and one of the chapters that I think was probably the least necessary. And I always have the feeling that these were basically introduced just to keep Matt in the forefront. The really interesting thing about this chapter is the first time you've really seen Matt in a long time, when he wasn't traveling with Vala Luka's show. I mean, he's really stuck with them for a long time. So, anybody else have any good ideas about this chapter?
Oh, I'm going back and rereading this portion of the chapter talking about when the Aes Sedai demand horses off of Matt. And it's actually after Matt has said, you know what, you don't have to stay here. If you want, you are more than welcome to head on your way. Just don't go back to the south where the Shanchanar. And then Jolene pops up with, it would be good for us to be away from your crudeness, Coffin. Prepare for us, say, 20 mounts, and we shall be off. And then Matt goes into, Matt is incredibly like, you're an idiot, no.
Well, part of that, though, and this is interesting, it's sort of a back-and-forth game of wits there. And, yeah, I the idea that, you know, they're trying to, like, negotiate a deal on how many horses it'll take for Matt to be rid of them. And, you know, it ultimately is going to go that Matt needs them for right now, in one way or another. So, well, and indeed, I mean, when you really look at it, the entire thing with Hinderstab and everything else, yeah, it's going to be necessary that they're still traveling together. It's possibly another, you know, lesser Tavaren twisting. But, you know, right now, the Aes Sedai are bound to Matt is, you know, as much as anybody else would be. And the idea of, you know, we'll give us 20 horses, it's like, no. I'll give you two. One for you, and one for you to ride when you run that horse to death. Sorry. Those horses could be good eaten later.
Ow.
I'm kidding. No horses were harmed in the making of this book either.
We hope.
We've seen many horses die and run to death and stuff and treated badly and having Mydril sit on top of them.
True. No, just it's, you know, what the Aes Sedai are asking is not feasible, and it takes somebody like Matt who has that kind of attitude to be able to look at them and go, you realize how ridiculous what you just said sounds, right?
Well, yeah, plus his sassy little Tarangreal doesn't hurt him either.
You know, it doesn't stop him from picking up a boulder and dropping it on his head, though.
This is true. But do they know that?
No, the thing stopping him from doing that is the 7,000 armed men who are 100% loyal to Matt Coffin.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
That might be a bit of a problem even for Ice and I think.
There's no might about it. They would die.
Yeah, I know what it takes is an arrow, right?
And unfortunately, Teslin would die with them, and that wouldn't be good.
Why do we have Teslin around?
Because Teslin's a good red. She's one of the few reds that I actually like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's black.
If she is, if she is black,
if you like her, then she's black. If she's red and you like her, then she's black.
Tavara is not black, and I like her too. But if it turns out that Teslin is black, you will all hear my scream of pain and anguish, and I won't even have to record it for you. You'll just hear it automatically floating on the air.
I am fairly certain she is not. Now that I've said that, I have to say, but I said it ironically, because if I don't, then we'll find out in a scene with Varen and Teslin in the next book and that she is, and then it'll just, it will be bad overall. So just remember,
okay. I
said that all in an ironic sense.
And moving on now to chapter 21, Embers and Ash.
These is actually jumps between the Ibarra's point of view. It goes from Perrin to Fael and then back to Perrin. Let's see. Reading over it real quick. I think we'll probably do the Fael point of view and then do the two Perrins together. And it starts with Fael is waiting for Perrin to sleep soundly, but he is still restless. It's been a full week since Maldon, and they are nearing the General Road. Things are going smoothly, though the Ashaman are still too tired for gateways, which means they're traveling on foot. That's got to be slow. Perrin seems haunted and sorrowful. Outside, you can hear the guards and one of the farriers, at work. She feels stronger since her captivity with Savannah and the Shaido. She had victories before, like the Chafail, the Two Rivers, and Aleandre, but Maldon taught her true leadership. Perrin wakes and again tells her he did not sleep with Verlaine. She believes him, but he still does not understand her jealousy. She fibs, telling him that no one in the Shaido camp would bother with Guy Shane. He does not need to know about Massima or Roland. It would tear him up if he knew that he killed someone who was trying to help her, and Massima's possessions are gone from his tent. As he falls asleep, Perrin worries what Rand will think about him losing Massima. He mumbles about watching Rand sleep, wondering what happened to his hand. Obviously, he's been having the swirling colors at this point in time. After he is asleep, Fael dresses and meets Arella and Lucille outside of her tent. Bane and Shia join them. They are both now Guy Shane to Gaul. They leave the camp and meet Aleandre. They have mementos from Kinhuin, Jordan, Roland, and Marthea, the Aiel, who had helped them. They carefully burn the mementos to honor their memory. Lucille says that Nygian, Guy Shane to Sulin, is one of the brotherless. She will tell him of what the others did for them. The past is now a bed of embers and ash. Discuss!
Well, I actually did kind of like this scene, particularly the entire fire and them remembering the brotherless, just because if we had not had this, then Roland really would have been a throwaway character. You know, and the fact that we did come back to it, there is at least some, you know, closure. And, you know, I can almost forgive Fael for her little, you know, fib to Perrin, even though Perrin's probably fairly certain through his very keen wolf senses of and knowing how she smells that, you know, she has in some way, shape, or form, kept something from him. I think it's just one of those things that he's going to know, and, going to be one of those things that he's going to have to learn to deal with. Him, you know, doing the entire thing about, again, rehashing the I didn't sleep with Berlaine, I know everybody is saying it, but I didn't do it. That was a bit tiresome, and, you know, I will be glad in the upcoming chapters when they finally just talk about it. The entire people, like, particularly couples not talking about things in the series has been a large sticking point for me for quite some time, so.
Yeah, and I'm kind of surprised, actually, that Fael didn't just come out and tell Perrin what happened, but, because I think it kind of would have made him feel a little bit better about the business with Berlaine, but I guess he's never going to do it at this point. She's going to go with the what happens is Guy Shane stays as Guy Shane, or Guy Shine. And you're right, I did appreciate the burning of the mementos being a nice memorial to them and a sense of closure and everything, but I almost would have rather that they had kept the mementos of them. I mean, I don't know. I suppose it's a matter of their customs and so forth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it also kind of boils down to they weren't able to go and get, you know, specifically Roland, and you know, they weren't able to go and get those bodies. They weren't able to actually perform a real funeral for them, and it would have looked odd if they had. So, I mean, in a way, this is as close as they can get to it, and, you know, at least it's something. You know, the idea is, you know, not necessarily that you need to keep a memento of the person. It's, you know, more about the closure of letting go of it in the first place.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. But one other thing that kind of, I'm going to reveal my ignorance here, but I just honestly do not remember that Bane and Chiard are Guy Shane de Gaulle.
Yep.
How did that happen? They weren't on they were on the same side.
Gaulle would I think it happened, and this could be betraying my ignorance of Aiel customs, but I'm pretty sure that when Gaulle killed whichever Aiel it was that had made them
right.
Guy Shane, that kind of had that bond with him, that he took it over.
He killed the person that held them and so that they became Gai Shan to him. Okay, I got it. I remember that now.
Well, it was one of those things where, if I remember properly, the one he is not overly fond of was the one he actually took first, and she ended up having to tell him, like, who he had to find and kill in order to take the other. Because it seemed like there was another one where it was like he was frantically searching for the right person in order to be able to, you know, perform an action so that he could take over that particular Guy Shane bond. I might be misremembering, and if I am, I terribly apologize to all characters involved, but...
I'm pretty sure it was Chiad, the one that he was in love with, not Bane.
Well, it's been so long since I've read through that particular portion of the book that I do remember there being an effort on his part to make certain that he took at least the one, but yeah.
Yeah, he was trying to go into Malden to get them. Yeah, I do remember
There was a lot of really cool things in this little part of the chapter, but there was also something that seemed kind of like a throwaway at first. But I have to wonder about it because Encyclopedia Watt did bring it up in one of their notes. But it's interesting where it says that Maesma's possessions have been gone from his tent. Encyclopedia Watt points out that we don't know if he took his possessions with him or if someone else has plundered his tent. But what could he have had in there that would have been worthwhile to either take with him or for someone else to come and steal?
Well, I mean, there is... We do know that he had quite a bit, he had amassed quite a bit of money from varying nobles and stuff that he was, you know, bringing to the Lord Dragon. We do know that he had, though he was using it for things, usually the welfare of people, he did have some substantial small amount of wealth with him. My theory on it, even if there were no money, was that the members of Cha Fael would have taken care of everything to make it seem as if Mishima had just taken off by himself.
Yeah.
To make it seem, I mean, let's not trumpet that we killed the guy.
Yeah, he just gone.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's my particular feeling on it. I don't necessarily know that it's necessarily as sinister as it could be, but maybe I'm wrong. I mean, if we are correct in thinking that Mishima was directed by one of the Forsaken, it's very possible that he could have had some sort of device, so, you know, in his possession, maybe without him knowing it, that would allow the Forsaken to appear and, you know, give that entire, "I am the Dragon Reborn, you must kill Paranaibara, doom," kind of feeling.
Yeah. You think that was one of the Forsaken appearing to him, or just a figment of his imagination?
Well, I totally think it was the Forsaken.
Yeah, we actually, and I'm going to go look and see if I can find it again now, but I read there have been several people both on Theoryland and on Dragonmount. Well, not several. There's been Therese on Theoryland, and the one I saw was Luckers, James Luckman of Dragonmount, who have compiled interviews and questions and answers during tours and from all sorts of other spots. And one of them that I was reading, I think it was the on the Dragonmount one, brought up this idea of Mazma and the mysterious visions, and it did say that he, and I'm trying to find it, shoot, and did say that he had, that he actually was being manipulated by someone else, that the mysterious figure actually was a person and not a figment of his imagination. And I'm going to find this if it kills me. And it might.
I vote for the Mandroid.
I do too, just because it seems like the kind of thing he would do, to step in and take over the role of the Dragon Reborn, even in so small a part as this. However, that being said, we know that's not going to be the only thing that the Mandroid has his finger in. We know for a fact that he's going to have other things too, and I think I might have found it. That he's going to have his finger in other things. I mean, because he said in the prologue of The Gathering Storm that he had armies ready. And someone spell Maizma for me. Here we are. Okay, someone asked, let's see if I can tell where this is from. I can't. Okay. Someone asked if Sanderson could reveal who was behind the visions that Maizma was having. Sanderson basically said that there was definitely someone involved with Maizma having visions. He did not provide any further details other to say that Maizma's visions weren't just from Maizma being crazy. This is on the Dragonmount forums, actually, in their general forum. Their general Wheel of Time discussion forum. Right near the top, there is a Team Jordan Q&A and interviews, which is from Luckers, and there's lots of links out there, and this is part of the Part A plot-related Q&A. So if you follow that meandering train, you can find what I'm reading right now. Moving on to the other point of view in Chapter 21, it's Perrin. And like I said, this is going to be actually two different points of view, because the chapter actually goes Perrin, Fael, Perrin. We're going to combine the two Perrin points of view. So it starts with Perrin is opening his eyes and he's finding himself in the wolf dream. The sky is stormy with unusual violent clouds. Hopper tells him to jump down, and he says that the last hunt comes. If Shadow Killer falls to the storm, all will sleep forever. Perrin tries to tell Hopper about losing control, but the wolf does not understand. Hopper wants to run. When Perrin insists that Hopper teach him, he is kicked out of the dream. And he wakes to find Fael gone. This is obviously after he had woken before and talked with Fael a bit, gone back to sleep. Fael has left. Perrin wakes to find her gone. He thinks to himself that she probably has just gone to the privy. So there are privies in this book, which is amazing for fantasy. Anyway.
Well, unless you're two on, in which case it's unnecessary.
Oh, yes. He thinks about Hopper and the wolf dream. He is headed for the last battle, and he wants to be in control of himself when it comes. He's avoided his problems, which would disappoint Master Lujan. He knows that he must decide to let Fael ride into danger. He decides to face his problem, and that gives him enough peace to go back to sleep. And can we just say, hallelujah, do something about this? Finally, child.
Yeah. Yeah, please.
This is a major good thing that will result in many, many blessings upon your head from all these people who have hated you for the last few books.
Well, hate might be too strong a word, but highly annoyed would certainly cover it.
Yeah, I was really interested. I mean, obviously, Perrin needs, number one, to get...
a wife. Oh.
Well, needs to command control of his new nature. I mean, ever since his eyes changed back in the Eye of the World, he has been mopey. And he only ever really uses his abilities reluctantly. And he's not really sought to learn about them and learn how to make use of them in a way that will benefit him. I mean, it's just, it's denying what he is. Yes, there's a great danger in not rigidly controlling the wolf aspect in him, but it is something that's a part of him. And it kind of amazes me that for someone as disciplined as a blacksmith's apprentice, he hasn't, like, figured this out by now.
Yeah,
there's a reason you use certain... I was going to say that there's a reason that you use certain metals for certain things and not others. And it just seems like knowing exactly how to work within yourself, it would be, a wonderful mirror on how you work a forge and how you work metals. So, I mean, it surprises me that it's taken him this long, not only just to decide, hey, this is what my goal's going to be, and I'm not going to look back on it now. I think some of the wording around the decision was something to the effect of, I've been spending so much time lacking a real goal, or so focused on one thing that I've neglected so much else of my life, and I need to not neglect that anymore. And that was something that was really nice to read.
Well, it's almost really astonished me with his nature of basically being, he's always considered from the time when they left the Two Rivers to be really the most responsible of the three boys. You know, he's the steady one. He's the methodical one. He's the one who thinks about everything before he does it and takes everything so seriously, even more than Rand, who, was fairly serious, but not... I don't think anywhere to the degree that Perrin was, and yet it's taken him all this time to come to grips with his true nature, what he now is, and what he has to become in order to be a part of the last battle. And it just astonishes me. And I think in that respect, Fael was a really bad influence on him, because she basically tied him up in knots and took so much of his emotional energy that he actually couldn't really work on himself at all. He made some strides when they went back to the Two Rivers, and he sort of started to settle in a little bit and, sort of ease into the role of a noble, but he couldn't stay there, and he knew he couldn't stay there. So it just amazes me that it's taken him this long to come to grips with it. And, I mean, even Matt, who's supposedly the irresponsible one, who just doesn't care about anything except gambling and playing dice or drinking and all these other things, even he has settled into his new persona remarkably well compared to Perrin. Rand probably settled into his a little too well, but thankfully that chapter's coming to a close as well. I don't know, it just seems sort of out of character for Perrin to be so much in denial for such a long time of his wolf nature.
Well, except that that's kind of been his character the entire time. From the time that he learned about his wolf nature, he hasn't really been denying it, but he's been trying to use it as little as possible. There seems like there's two extremes, where we have the man that we saw in, I want to say, Dragon Reborn, who had been locked in the back, who had gone incredibly feral. Feral?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the right word?
Mm-hmm.
I think so. Well, and somewhere in the middle, not the other extreme, somewhere in the middle is Elias, or however you wish to pronounce his name. And then Perrin seems like he was trying to be on the other extreme, trying to deny it or use it as little as possible. Where in fact, he really needs to be somewhere more in the middle where Elias is, where
It's a perfect balance. He's not letting it control him, but he's still not trying to suppress it.
Yeah, you're probably right. I didn't look at it quite that way, but that's a good, really good point. One thing I think that we do need to mention is that the scene where Perrin wakes in the first section of his point of view, where he's floating in the air in the wolf dream, and the storm is sky in Telaronrad is stormy with unusual violent clouds, and there's actually a note at the end of the chapters here which reminded me to talk about this, but apparently the influence of the Dark One on this odd black and silver set of clouds is so strong that now it's leaking into Telaronrad. That's kind of scary when you think about it. Barriers between the worlds and dimensions, if you will, are really starting to thin.
Well, I mean, that was kind of, I know we mentioned it a couple podcasts ago, the ever-present clouds, you know, Egwene sees them when going into Telaronrad, and, you know, there are a number of places where we end up seeing these clouds appear, and just the idea that I think this is one of the first notes that we've seen where it is really, really attributed to being an effect of the Dark One, and it's not just, you know, something, and moreover that it is that way because it is so predominantly fixed in the real world that it's gaining permanence, or even, you know, close to actual permanence in Telaronrad. And it's just the entire state of the pattern is so thick with the Dark One's, I don't want to say essence, but I mean essentially, that yes, now Telaronrad, where the ephemeral reign supreme, is, you know, slowly becoming more and more codified.
Essence of the Dark One. I actually saw that at Walmart the other day. It's a men's glove, I think, isn't it?
Essence of the Dark One by Calvin Klein.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. You know, honestly, I'm not sure because, well, there's really the clouds in this book are really very interesting. And there's any number of plausible reasons. I think the easiest one, the one that most people latch onto, because it's the one that the characters in the book latch onto, is the Dark One is touching the world. But there are a lot of other theories out there, and some that are really, really persuasive, might I say, well put together. My favorite is that Rand, being the Dragon Reborn, is actually influencing the land. The prophecy is
land is one with the dragon, and the dragon is one with the land. There could be no health in the land if the dragon reborn, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
And see, I don't have that memorized, and yet you do.
Well,
anyway.
I don't have it exactly memorized, but
hence the yada yada.
Yeah. Yeah, but I found really interesting about this is at the end, when Hopper kicks him out of the dream, why, first off, and how? Have we ever really seen anyone get kicked out? I mean, we've seen people get pulled out, but I don't remember having seen people get kicked out of Telaronrad before.
A couple of times people have been kicked out by having their Tarangriel ripped away from them in the dream.
That would be painful.
Sylvie did it to Egwene in the Stone of Tyr in Telaronrad, and I believe Nynaeve did it to Siwan when they were, she was mad at her or something, but I could be wrong about that. And I think that Hopper kicked Perrin out once before. I think he pushed him off a cliff or had him jump off a cliff or something like that, and he woke before he hit the ground, but I'm not quite sure about that. It seems like Hopper kicked him out once before.
There is an instance in which, if I'm remembering properly, Brigitte forces one of the girls out. And it might have just been an earlier one where, like, she pretended, or like she, you know, started to draw an arrow and, you know, it just basically caused her to flee. But I mean, we've seen instances where people within the dreams were sort of responsible for making a person leave the dream, whether that's an actual just boot or, you know, I'm not certain. I think the wise ones may have been capable of doing some stuff. I don't really remember all of the wise ones training Egwene. But it is very possible that, yes, someone more experienced in Teleron Riad can force a person into a different state. I am not 100% certain.
You're probably right. I agree.
We're done talking about Chapter 21 now. We're going to go on to the next, actually, couple of chapters. These are really, really powerful chapters, and they really kind of need to go together. So we're going to, there's three points of view, and we're going to have Virginia do the first one, then Andrew will do the one in the middle, and then the next, actually, chapter, the point of view for that, Virginia will do again, and then we'll go through and discuss them all.
Okay, Chapter 22 is entitled The Last That Could Be Done, and it is from our dear friend Samarog's point of view.
Samarog.
It sounds operatic, doesn't it? Anyway, Samarog sits alone in her room. She does not understand how she could have been so humiliated by Cadswain with her Perales net. Chida Haran appears. He tells her she failed greatly, injuring Rand, revealing herself, losing valuable pawns, being captured, and broken. Her shield vanishes, and she can channel again. Chida Haran tells her that she has been given one last chance. She tries the door then, and it opens to reveal three corpses. Elza Penfell kneels before her. She tells Samarog that she is instructed to remove the compulsion on her and gives her the domination band, otherwise known as the sad bracelets.
From here we shift to Rand's point of view. Rand on Tide Ashar with Bashar and Itrold, along with 50 soldiers, 50 maidens, and Nerishma, ride through northern Saldea near the Blight. Lúthien remembers the area. Saldea looks familiar to Faldara. Lon told him that a boy becomes a man when he earns the right to a sword. They can see the foothills of the Mountains of Doom. The Blight is slowly advancing. Rand orders Nerishma to open a gateway, then tells Itrold to send reports via Ashaman to Bandar Aban. He will move his headquarters there in 4 days. Rand thinks that he can trust Nerishma, one of the men from Dumai's Wells. Lúthien does not. Rand thinks back to his dream of Moradin with no Lúthien in his head. He wonders why Moradin saved him as Shadar Logoth when fighting Samael. He thinks that he must be hard, and yet men does not want that. To live, you must die. How can one laugh in the face of that? Lúthien tells him that Min is right. He must break the seals. Lúthien says they touched the Dark One with Sadin, and that is how he tainted it. Dira Bashar is waiting for her husband. Rand thinks of Tam as his father, even though he knows Jonduin was his real father. A small voice in his mind asks if he cares about his legacy. He founded schools in Cairhien and Andor because he wanted to leave something behind other than destruction. Now he thinks he cannot fix everything. The voice asks if the goal is to survive or to thrive. Back at the manor, Lord Talayn still complains of the smoke smell. Rand goes to his room where Min is waiting. A serving woman moves dishes. As he talks to Min, something clicks around his neck. The serving woman is actually Samarog, and she puts the Dominion band on him. Min throws a knife, which grazes Samarog, and in retaliation, Samarog knocks Min to the floor and gags her with air. Elza enters and dons the other bracelet. Samarog then tortures Rand, but the pain hardly affects him. He tells her that there is nothing more that she can do to him, but in response she smiles and forces him to hold Sadin and begin to torture Min instead. She tells him to beg. He does, and Min's torture stops. Then Rand begins to strangle Min under Samarog's direction. Something inside Rand at this moment snaps, and all emotion goes away. He can sense a new force in his mind, and despite Lúthien's desperate pleas, Rand takes a hold of it. The collar around his neck explodes as Rand channels the true power, and Samarog looks stunned, realizing what must have happened, and asks the Great Lord as to why he betrayed her. Rand then uses Balefire to destroy her and Elza. As Min recovers, he tells her that they have now taken everything from him. It was the last that could be done.
Okay, then we move on to chapter 23, which is called The Warp in the Air. This particular chapter is from Cadswain's point of view. And we open Cadswain, Maurice, and Narishmo walking through the manor to check on Rand. They are followed by Sorrelia, Amice, and other wise ones. Maurice reports that Gin is dead, but Nasuni and Corell were left in a deep trance. Whoever freed Semirog did not have to alert their warders. Maidens swarm outside Rand's room. Serene, Eris, and Beldine are inside. Elza is missing. Min sits on the bed, pale and disheveled with his neck. Cadswain is shocked by Rand. He is utterly unemotional, but there is a darkness about him. He shows Narishma how to scale fire. Cadswain is extremely angry, but Rand says it is needed to permanently kill the Forsaken. Semirog is dead. Cadswain is further shocked to see that the sad bracelet is on the bed. Rand has her box open despite her wards, and the access key is also gone. For failing to keep the sad bracelets from Semirog, Rand exiles Cadswain on pain of death. The air seems to warp and the room appears darker. Rand says that he can kill her simply by willing it, and she believes him. Rand tells everyone in the room to prepare to leave.
Yeah, this is one of those moments in which Brandon's warning that Rand could go lower than he already was really snapped into place, because everything shifted with these two chapters. I mean, the storyline took a decidedly darker turn. And, you know, even the fact that whether it's due to the true power or a shift in his Taveran nature, literally the air is starting to warp, bend, and darken around him. I mean, what evil genius has ever not wanted that?
Yeah, it's a pretty nice effect if you can pull it off.
An aura of darkness surrounds him.
Yeah, I mean, and it does. It you know, suddenly you have to start wondering, wow, you know, if this is the effect he has just by being present, how close is he to tipping over to, you know, the side of the Dark One? I mean, how much does it take? And, you know, how close are we to the brink?
I think it's interesting, you know. Go ahead. I'm
sorry. Oh, yeah. No, I was going to say it's interesting to note in here with the entire, when Min recovers, her neck is still bruised, which means that the balefire that Rand uses to destroy Semirog and Elza is actually really, really minute, because they're only burned a few minutes back in time, even if it's even that long.
Yeah, more like a few moments.
Yeah. And just the idea that, you know, Rand was dealing really well, and we know that Semirog is the master of breaking people. I mean, that's just her entire, that was her entire mystique. And, you know, just the idea that she could see that hurting him wasn't doing anything. So, you know, well, we can use the power to torture him, but, you know, that's not really pushing him far enough. You know, if you're truly, truly wanting to break him, and I mean, honestly, what Semirog was instructed to do by Shadar Aran essentially was to, you know, to bring him, like, anguish and pain that wasn't physically debilitating. And then, you know, the concept of, well, you know, we'll just have him torture people that he loves seems like such a natural thing that I can't fathom how they would miss that might trigger a psychotic episode due to the memories he has from Luz Thurin.
Yeah.
I mean, now granted, she couldn't have foreseen that Rand would have access to the true power at all. I mean, that, you know, Semirog was probably having a grand old time until that necklace exploded.
Yeah, that kind of came out of left field for her.
Yeah, and there's tons of conversation that we could do and had done about exactly what that means. But, you know, for now, I think for this forum, we just, it happened. And it seems, well, no, I'm not even going to go to that. It happened. But, you know, and there seems to be really two climaxes in these two chapters. The first is obviously where Rand has, where Rand takes hold of the true power. And not only does he use the true power, which is in essence the Dark One, but he balefires two women with it, which breaks his first cardinal rule. And that is a huge climax. But to me, even stronger than that is the climax that we get in the next chapter, which is the final paragraph when Cad Swain is back in his presence. And we have this, I don't think that ever in her entire long life she has ever been more afraid for her life than she was here. I don't think that there was fear for the world here. I don't think that there was worry about what Rand was becoming. I think that this was pure and unbridled fear. Unfortunately, it didn't humble her. We see later on she was not humbled by this experience. That would have been nice. But she is afraid beyond her... I mean, she starts stuttering. She can't even put together... her speech patterns change. She acts completely different, which we might attribute to a change in the writing. I don't think so. I think that this is powerful enough that this was probably written by Robert Jordan himself. I've got to read it. I've got to just read this straight out. It's Cad Swain. Do you believe that I could kill you right here, right now, without using a sword or the power? Do you believe that if I simply willed it, the pattern would bend around me and stop your heart by coincidence? Being Taveren didn't work that way. Lied, it didn't, did it? He couldn't bend the very pattern to his will, could he? And yet, meeting his eyes, she did believe. Against all logic, she looked in those eyes and knew that if she didn't leave, she would die. The power and emotion that is coursing through this part of the chapter, I think, even eclipses what we've seen before. Because we know how strong Cad Swain is as a character. And yet here she is bought into the deepest depths of fear that we've seen any character go through at the hands of our hero, our protagonist.
And isn't it funny that our protagonist has now become one of the darkest characters in the book? Not by choice. You know, he was so worried about, you know, fighting the Dark One and because of the, you know, the dreams and the prophecies and everything, you know, being turned to the Dark One and everything. And it wasn't even necessary. Mere events were enough to conspire to turn him that way. I mean, he sort of went the way of the people of Eridol. He became almost as dark as they are in order to destroy the shadow by himself. It was to the point where he doesn't even have to think about using the power or a sword to kill somebody. He could just cause the pattern to bend itself around her and do that. It's like, wow, you know, that's pretty heavy duty stuff. And yeah, I could see why even someone as strong as Cad Swain would be pretty, you know, frightened, scared spitless, you know, by somebody. I mean, they've always said all along that he's one of the strongest channelers ever to live. They've always said all along that he's one of the strongest Taveren, or probably the strongest Taveren ever, including Hawkwing, and I think, I forgot who it was that said it, that Arthur Hawkwing was in no way as strong as Rand. And yet, they're all surprised when they see the manifestation of those things, you know, developing in front of them.
Well, I mean, and two, the closing of Cad Swain's chapter is telling of that. Yeah, Cad Swain raised a hand to her head and leaned against the hallway wall outside, heart thumping and her hand sweating. Before, she had always been working with a stubborn but good-natured or good-hearted boy. Someone had taken that child and replaced him with this man, a man more dangerous than any she had ever met. Day by day, he was slipping away from them, and at the moment, she hadn't a blasted clue what to do about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's so far out of anyone's ken. All they remember is Rand, the boy. You know, mm-hmm. whenever anyone has met him in the series up to this point, he was a boy. I mean, she says right before the part that Spencer read earlier, you know, it's like, but, you know, everyone knows you don't kill women. Everyone knows it. You can hardly put the maidens into danger for fear of them getting hurt. You know, and his response to that, you know, is just something you never thought you'd hear out of Rand. I've been forced to reassess, you know, that viewpoint or something to that particular effect. It's, yeah. You know, there is, I mean, it is a total change of person that's been coming for quite a long time. I mean, Rand has been, you know, stealing himself and trying to make himself less and less human. And really, the only way that he could accomplish it was by being deprived of the things that he was holding on to that were going to keep him human. You know, it was the entire, you know, it's hopeless. Regardless of what I can do, my enemies can make me do what I have been trying and straining myself to avoid. I don't want to kill women. I don't want to hurt women. And here I am because, you know, there's a Terran gorilla around my neck. They're making me, against my will, kill someone not just a woman, but one I love.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that switch. It's the final little off switch in what holds him back from, you know, jumping over one side of the knife's edge.
It sort of reminds me, probably on a greater scale than that, but every time I think about that chapter, read that chapter, it brings me in mind of a scene from The Dark Knight when the Joker is taunting Batman. I mean, the difference is that in The Wheel of Time, there isn't any one character that's necessarily pushing him to the edge. It's everything pushing him to the edge. I mean, we could probably say that the Dark One is manipulating things to bring him to that, you know, in order to turn the champion of the light to the shadow. But I just, it makes me think of that quote where the Joker is taunting Batman and he says, you have these rules that you live by and you think they're going to save you, but you're going to have to break your one rule. And then Batman says, I'm considering it. He says, no, you're going to have to play my little game if you want to save one of them. You know, and it just reminds me of that whole scene, you know, where that's his one rule, and he's just been forced to break it, and he's just gone completely over the edge. And at that point, when does the force of good descend to become the tool of evil? It's a kind of a common theme in literature, and it's certainly been a common theme in movies lately. You know, we've got, as I said, The Dark Knight, and then also the same thing happened in Spider-Man 3. You know, when does the good guy get pushed so hard that he becomes exactly what he's fighting? You know, and we've seen it in this book. We've seen it with the whole city of Eridol, the whole nation of Eridol, fighting against the Shadow, and in the process becoming so evil that even the minions of the Shadow quailed in front of them. You know, it's sort of a recurring theme, and at this point in time, it just doesn't seem like there's any hope for Rand to get over that. So it's fascinating to me the way that this whole thing has developed and how it's been resolved so far, because I don't really think that whole story's done. I know he's had, and I'm going to spoil the end chapter, and I know he's had his change, his epiphany, you know, later in the book, but that darkness within him didn't just go away. It's going to still taint him in a way. It's going to affect him in a way. And things that he's done are probably always going to haunt him, even though he's eventually comes to realize that there's a way around it.
Oh, but man.
It's a scary chapter, really.
Yeah. Oh, man, dang it, Virginia. You just spoiled my fantasies of It's a Wonderful Life-esque ending with Rand coming in. Man, where are you?
That was good. That was very, very good. That was a very nice impression. I am glad. I'd actually like to take this back just a little bit. One of the really nice notes in chapter 22 is that, you know, the three people who were maintaining Samarog's shield were Karel, Nasune, and Daigon. And only Daigon is actually dead. The other two were placed in a very deep trance. Shadar Haran knew which Aes Sedai had warders, as which would be alerted if their Aes Sedai were killed or harmed. At a signing, Brandon Sanderson actually stated that Shadar Haran was working through Elza. And Elza was therefore his source of information, but the experience of working or being used as a tool by Shadar Haran was not a pleasant experience for her.
The experience that Alvi Aran had with Shadar Haran, and that was just getting marked by him, wasn't pleasant. I can't imagine being turned into a puppet, Mydral Dreadlord,
yeah.
Or actually more of a Mydral Forsaken, would be at all comfortable.
He's actually, he's actually the literal hand of the dark. He's the dark one working through Super Fade. And you know, look at how he, look how he dealt with Silgarion. I mean, it was very strongly implied that there were more than physical abuse, you know.
Oh, yeah.
The Mydral have to have their pleasures, you know. And then she even reflects that most women would have been raving insane after what she'd been through, but she still was, still held her sanity. But, oh, my goodness, the very thought.
Well, I was also glad in this particular chapter there are actually two separate Tarangriel that are given names in Chapter 22. There is the Perilous Net,
mm-hmm.
which is the terminology for Cadswain's hair ornaments, which is very, very nice because obviously it reinforces that these sorts of Tarangriel were created and used during the War of the Power. And the other one is the Bands of Dominion. Or the domination band.
Domination, actually, yeah. Domination.
Yeah, the domination bands. And you know what? I love that name so much more than the sad bracelets.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, the domination bands. It's like, oh, that's beautiful. Which technically means that the Aes Sedai who created the Adam over in Seanchan was probably working through knowledge that may have ended up being passed down or, depending on various other things, was somehow possibly communicated to her or at least rediscovered by her because they all work on the same, the principle, the involuntary link. So the idea is that the Adam is also a throwback from the Age of Legends back during the War of the Shadow.
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah, I was kind of like, oh.
I think the other cool thing that we see in this chapter was that we see a direct reference to Viren's compulsion from the Path of Daggers, when she was laying her special little cobbled-together brand of compulsion on all the captured Aes Sedai, Elza being one of them. And then Cymarog was instructed to remove it. Elza could do what the Dark One wanted her to do instead of helping the Dragon Reborn make it to the last battle, I guess, as Viren had compelled her to do.
Yeah, I have to kind of state, though, remove this compulsion from her brain. Much good it's going to do her.
Yeah, she could be toasted anyway, but still,
Yeah, well, I have to wonder. I have to wonder if Shadar Haran knew about the compulsion. Obviously, he was working through Elza, and so there is a large possibility that he found it out there. But I also have to wonder if he somehow found out who had woven the compulsion, or if he knew that.
I don't know. Viren thought that it couldn't be detected. So, I mean, I realize that the Super Fade has very special powers that nobody else has, but it seems to be kind of unlikely that he would be able to have that power in particular be awfully convenient.
Yeah, well, another thing that I think is really interesting in this chapter, well, first off, just a little side note, is we don't know what happened to Elza's warder, who is Faryl. Back to the kind of bigger things, it's really interesting. We see it, we see it first in the end of Warp in the Air, but then we also see it again and repeating later. As something that we have not seen before, we have never actually witnessed the pattern warping itself around Rand, who is a Taveren. We have never seen this before now. And unfortunately, we're seeing it now when Rand is in his deepest, darkest spot. And so rather than seeing kind of like what was purported with Arthur Hawkwing, that you could see the pattern swirling around him, and I have a feeling that always in my head I've seen kind of like glimmers and weird crap, psychedelic trip, whatever. But here it specifically says that from the corner, this from Catswain's point of view, she turned, and from the corner of her eye she saw a deep darkness emanating from Althor, warping the air even further. It's just interesting to finally we're seeing the pattern actually warp around Rand. We're seeing Rand exercise his Taveren muscle and get the pattern to do what he wants it to. But this is not the Rand that we want to have that power.
This is not something we want him to be doing because he's creepy crazy guy right now.
Oh, yeah. And what is with this, him being able to suddenly just kill her by simply willing it? I mean, that's never really been, that's not been in the series anywhere before that I've ever heard of, other than perhaps the Dark One himself. And even, I don't even think if we've seen, well, maybe we saw Ishamael do a couple of his minions that way, I suppose.
Well, no, because Ishamael doesn't have power over the pattern. Rand, as a Tavaren, it seems that he has the power to bend the pattern. I wouldn't be surprised if that was an idle threat.
But the way it was delivered and just the things that were going on right there, it would be enough to scare her out of her...
well,
yeah,
it is...
It would convince me.
Well, it is also that concept that, you know, now that he's in this cold, emotionless place, you know, he realizes that there's a lot more to Tavaren bending the pattern around them than just, oh, look, fish will stand on their ends when they fall out of a basket and they'll form the Aes Sedai symbol. You know, it's not just random things. The pattern's bending around him for reasons. And it's the concept of, you know, if you're the fulcral point for something and you take, like, you've got a heavy weight attached to a rope, which is attached to you, and you're swinging in a circle in that, if you start taking steps in a certain direction, you're changing the course of the rope and the rock, and, you know, you can sort of direct where it's going to end up going. And, you know, Rand's kind of doing that with the pattern and realizes that it might be possible to do so. I honestly don't doubt that it was an idle threat, but it's the fact that he realizes that Tavaren changed the probability of what's going to happen. You know, the concept always with Matt's luck had been, you know, what might only occur once every 100 times is, you know, 75% or 99% or, you know, even 100% more likely to occur just because of the way the Tavaren pull affects the pattern. And Rand's wording, his choice of words is very specific. Like, do you believe that if I simply willed it, the pattern would bend around me and stop your heart by pause coincidence? Because what happens is coincidence happens more frequently or has a greater chance of happening around Tavaren. And if you can willfully control the Tavaren nature, that puts you in a place where almost anything can happen. And, you know, as later we will see, Rand's effect on Tavaren is severely affected by this shift in his mental landscape.
I have this mental image of Rand, because we know he's a pretty smart guy, and he himself thought he would have been a very good student, so presumably he's been continuing to study these things that are happening to him and the effects that he can have on the world. I mean, obviously he took up the sword and took it all the way to become a blade master, basically defeating other blade masters. He had to learn the power, so he did learn to use the power, and now he's become quite skilled with it and other things. So I have this mental image of him sitting in his room practicing bending the pattern around him, sort of like, you know, Spider-Man powers, you know, scene. And just what has he been doing to try and learn how to bend the pattern around him? How creepy is that? You know, because you know he's had to been thinking about it all this time. He thinks about everything. That's his problem. He thinks too much. And then what you were talking about with Tavaren made me think of Bashir. I think it was Bashir who said it. Well, it can't be all cakes and ale being Tavaren. Yeah, it's the dark side of it here. Is there any record, has there been any mention in the book of evil Tavaren? So far, all the Tavaren we've been told about have been basically pretty much good guys. Arthur Hawkwing and a number of those were mentioned. I think one woman was mentioned.
It hasn't been mentioned, but obviously because history would want to hide the fact, and, you know, the glorious hero Tavaren are more likely to be known. But the pattern strives for balance, and so I think if it needed a Tavaren who was a dark friend, it would spin one out. For some reason the whatever cosmic scales it had were balanced too heavy on the side of good, it would balance it out, because the pattern is neutral. The creator is not. The Dark One is not. But the pattern itself is.
That makes me wonder why there are no Tavirin Forsaken. Why are none of the Tavirin Forsaken? I mean, why are none of the Forsaken Tavirin? I can't talk.
Because that's not what the pattern wants right now.
But it might be fun.
I don't think the pattern is greatly concerned with whether or not it would be fun.
And that's my whole problem with everything, you know? That's the problem. The pattern just doesn't give a rip what I want. But then again, there could be any number of Dark Fin Tavirin, and we just don't know about it. I mean, some of the bad guys have got to get lucky once in a while, right?
Well, I mean, right now they have enough influence over events that I don't think they need that extra, look at me, whoop-a-da-doo.
What's this? Watch this. Very scary. I think it's interesting that there are notes in the summaries here that the two of the pawns that Semirag was punished for being, for having let go, were the valuable pawns. It says here were Tuon and Suroth, possibly. That seems reasonable. Tuon and or Suroth, it says. And is nobody going to shed a tear for poor Daigian? Yeah, it's the guy who lost her Ashaman warden. Eben, I think it was, wasn't it, Eben?
Well, she's also fairly weak as Aes Sedai go. In fact, she was, if I'm remembering correctly, and I may not be, but if I am remembering correctly, she was so weak that it was almost a surprise that she got her shawl, just because you wouldn't think she would be able to.
Yeah, it was said in the book that I think the phrase was that she attained the ring by a fingernail and the shawl by an eyelash, something like that. I mean, she was very, very weak, longer a novice and accepted than probably anybody. And yet she bonds a fairly strong Ashaman. I think that was kind of weird. Corel, of course, being one of the ones that's in a trance, she's one of the best healers, so that's going to be a tough one because I don't know how many healers there are in the vicinity right now that are really good, except Fanive, I guess. And she's off somewhere, traipsing around the borderlands, I believe.
All right, well, I think that's going to wrap up our recap for this episode. We have a lot of good stuff in here. Yeah, I have nothing more to add to that. Andrew, tell them how they can get a hold of us.
Yes, if you see anything that we have missed, anything you thought that we covered fairly well, if you have any crazy ideas, theories, you know, any sort of feedback at all, are we coming through loud and clearly now? Or do we still sound like we're in tin cans? Anything at all that you want to talk about, you can always get a hold of us. You can call and leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
And I'll have you know I am broadcasting through the finest tin can known to mankind. No, and seriously. No, and you can also reach us by email at podcast@dragonmount.com. You can also leave comments on the individual podcast post pages, and we'll probably get back to you one way or the other fairly quickly. Maybe more than one on who's doing what when.
Yep, and those podcast posts are found on our homepage, which is dragonmount.com/podcast. At least it is as of right now, as of this recording. I don't know that we don't know exactly what it'll be after DM 8.0 comes up. I'm hoping it'll be the same, just because I don't want to have to memorize a whole new URL. It hurt my head. But also on dragonmount.com, on their forum section, you can find the 4th Age forum that you all need to start using, because no one uses it, and it needs used. Mind you, until DM 8.0 goes up, you can use it all you want, but they won't stay there for long.
Anyway, I think that'll pretty much wrap up this episode. We thank you once again for joining us. We hope that you are enjoying this redo of the Gathering Storm as much as we are, and eagerly awaiting the advent of the Towers of Midnight, which, as we speak here, is less than 2 months away. So, I want to thank Andrew and Spencer for being here, as always. Couldn't possibly do this without everybody, and in particular Spencer for doing all of the setup work and everything to get these recordings done. It's a huge help, and also I just want to take a moment to thank all of our editors who are doing such a fantastic job. Due to the upgrade of Dragon Mount and everything, you haven't seen quite as many posts put out as we actually have ready, because the transfer files and everything precluded posting new podcasts for a little while, but we have a number of them, and I'll probably just dump them all on at one time. So by the time you hear this, you will have seen some faster podcast release, I think. And so until the next episode, I thank you again for joining us. And this is Virginia, as always, hoping that the light will illumine you until we meet again.
And until next time, may you find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Sarapyananda Manchima, Taishite. So we will now continue on with
episode 20
on a broken road.
I got it.
What?
I haven't lost mine since I got it, just so I don't ruin it.
Yeah.
I'm lying, but that's beside the point.
I wore mine the one time and haven't done anything.
Matt,
We'll carry on our conversation, Andrew, you just keep going.
Yeah, we've been meaning to talk to you about watching those shirts, Spencer. And speaking of misspellings, okay, speaking of misspellings, our resident non-speller, Beckner. Beckner. Spelled your own name.
I have misspelled my own name many, many times.
Beckner. You are now Beckner forever.
No, this is no joke. When I first got onto Facebook, I literally misspelled my name Beckner when I first got on. And so I had to go back in to change it.
I misspelled my Verignia a couple of times, but I've never let it stand that way. I misspelled it, oh crap, you know, and then typed it back again. I've never actually let it go.
I don't pay enough attention to it when I send them. I just don't check my spelling on my name.
Apparently not. You are now Spectner Kron.
Okay.
Nilal's brother, Spectner.
Okay.
Could call Brandon. It's another character named Brandon.
Okay, so we should probably mute Virginia so I can read the chapter summary.
I'm sorry, Spencer. I couldn't resist. It's Andrew's fault with the Captain. All right, I'll be good. More wine, please.